sum over I and j, delta phi I, j I j inverse, delta phi j, and minus 1/2 sum on I, 1 minus hyperbolic tangent squared of phi bar divided by t, and then delta phi I divided by t squared, okay? Okay, so first of all, the linear terms are supposed to cancel because we are expanding around the minimum of this Ginzburg-Landau functional. So why do they cancel? Okay, so let's see what this is equal to. So sum over I and j, or sum over j, sorry. So sum over j, j I j inverse, okay? So let's recall the Fourier transform of this thing, right? So I have j of q, this is equal to 1 over n, sum over I and j, j I j e to minus I q dot r I minus r j, right? That's just the Fourier transform of the interaction matrix. Now, so the same, of course, is true for the matrix J I J inverse, right? So I have J inverse of Q is equal to 1 over N sum over I and J, J I J inverse E to minus I Q dot ri minus rj, right? But since this matrix is diagonal in the q representation, in the momentum representation, this is just 1 over j of q, right? So this is equal to 1 over j of q, right? And so we have our expression for j of q, so this is approximately 1 over j minus 1/2 k q squared, right? And so then you see that this sum here, this is in fact equal to just j inverse of q equals 0, right? If I set here q equal to 0, I will get precisely that sum, so therefore the sum is simply equal to 1 divided by j, where j is this parameter from the mean field theory, okay? So, okay, so this, let me just replace this then by 1 over j. So this is sum over I phi bar divided by j, and then you see that the coefficient of the linear term, of the coefficient of delta phi I, is simply the mean field equation for phi bar. And that's why it vanishes, right? So we have phi bar equals j times hyperbolic tangent of phi bar divided by t, okay? So if you are expanding about the solution that satisfies this equation, right, then the coefficient of the linear term indeed vanishes, as it should, because we are expanding about the minimum. Okay, so this goes away then. Okay, so now let me just to write this in a more compact form. Let me introduce a matrix. Let me introduce a matrix with the following matrix elements. Let me call it capital A, IJ. And so this is going to be the matrix of this quadratic form of the fluctuations. Yeah. Well, it doesn't matter. At q equals 0, it's exact. It's exactly 1 over j.
And so this cancellation is exact.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this quadratic q dependence is approximate. It's only valid at q equals at small q, but at q equals 0, it's exactly 1 over j. Okay, so I want to define a matrix. So 1 over t, j, I, j inverse, and then minus 1 over t squared, and so 1 minus hyperbolic tangent squared of phi bar divided by t times delta ij, right? And actually, let me simplify this even further. Let me just use this mean field equation. So a hyperbolic tangent of phi bar divided by t is nothing but phi bar divided by j, right? So this is equal to, in fact, 1 over t, jij inverse, minus, so 1 over t squared, phi bar, 1 minus, so 1 over minus 1 over t squared, 1 minus phi bar divided by j squared times delta ij, okay? And so then I can write my expansion of s of phi as s of phi bar plus 1/2 sum over I and j delta phi I a I j delta phi j. Okay, and so a I j is nothing but the matrix of the second derivatives of the Ginzburg-Landau functional with respect to phi I and phi j, right? Okay, so now we can actually evaluate the correction to z, to the partition function, from these fluctuations, right? So I have z now. This is equal to integral d phi e to minus s of phi. And so we are approximating that by e to minus s of phi bar. And then I have integral d delta phi, and then e to minus 1/2 sum over I and j delta phi I a I j delta phi j, right? And so this is a Gaussian integral. So it's quadratic. That is an exponential of a quadratic form, right? And so you can just look at the Haber-Stratonovich identity and write down the result, right? So this integral is simply equal to 1 over the square root of the determinant of this matrix, okay? So this is equal to, let me write it here. So z is just equal to 1 over the square root of the determinant of A, and then E to minus S of phi bar, okay? Okay, so what I want to do now is kind of assess, so this 1 over the square root of the determinant of A, so that's the contribution of fluctuations, okay? So I want to assess somehow quantitatively its magnitude. Okay? Sorry? Well, we want that to be small, right, compared to the mean field result.
Smaller, then it's going to
Well, that's, you know, that's precisely. So it's not convenient to assess its correction to Z, right? So I want to look at some physical quantity, okay? And so a convenient physical quantity here will be the specific heat. Reason being that, so if you remember, so we found before, the specific heat experience is a jump of order one, right, equal to 3/2, at the mean field transition point, right? So then, if you calculate, if you evaluate the correction from this thing to the specific heat, right, then we can easily assess how large it is. If it's much smaller than one, then everything is fine. If it's not, then it's not fine. Okay. Okay. So let's now evaluate the correction to specific heat. So let's find the correction to specific heat at constant volume, right? So I can, given Z, I can calculate the free energy. So this is minus T log of Z, right? And then the specific heat is just minus 1 over N T, the second derivative of the free energy with respect to temperature, right? Okay, so let's evaluate first this correction to F. So let me start here. Okay, so if I plug this result for Z in here, I get F equals so minus T log Z, so I get T S of phi bar, and this is just mean field result for the free energy. So I'll call it F mean field. And then the correction is going to give me, so plus T log of the square root of the determinant of A, right? Which is, okay, so this is F mean field plus 1/2 T log of the determinant of A. And so log of the determinant of A, what is that? So I can diagonalize, well, the determinant is invariant with respect to change of basis. So I can diagonalize the matrix A. Then the determinant is just product of the eigenvalues. And so then you see that log of the determinant is actually the same as trace of logarithm, right? Because log of the product of the eigenvalues is sum of the logs of eigenvalues. So this is equal to F mean field plus 1/2 T trace of the log of A. Trace being sum of the eigenvalues. Okay. So trace is sum okay. Okay, so let me now rewrite this this matrix A in a slightly different form, and then we will actually be able to express it in terms of something that we already know. Okay, so I have Aij, this is equal to 1 over T Jij inverse minus 1 over T squared 1 minus phi bar divided by j squared times delta ij. Okay, so let me write this in the following. Let me move this matrix Jij inverse all the way to the right. So this is equal to 1 over t sum over L delta I L minus 1 over T, so 1 minus phi bar divided by J squared. So here I will have J I L, right? And then here J inverse L J, right? So this is the same thing. And now this, what I have here in the square brackets, if you look back, this is nothing but the inverse of the correlation function. Inverse of the mean field correlation function, which we have already calculated. So this is G inverse IL, okay? Okay, so this whole thing is just equal to 1 over T sum over L G inverse I L J inverse L J. Okay. Okay, so now I have here I have log of A, right? So this is basically, okay, let me write it in a matrix form, right? I have just A equals 1 over T G inverse J inverse, right? So log of A, I can write as a sum of two terms, log G inverse plus log, so J inverse divided by T, okay? And so let me ignore this part, okay? Reason being that, you know, this just adds an innocent term to the free energy. It's not going to be singular in any way at the transition point. So let me just throw it away and focus on this contribution. That's proportional to the inverse of the correlation function. Okay, so then I have... Well, you know, because, so, you know, if I put here T equals TC, there is obviously no singularity, right? It's the same idea as, you know, when I did the Hubbard-Sertonovich transformation, I threw out that constant in front. Okay, so now I have F equals F mean field plus 1/2 times T times trace of log of G inverse, okay? Okay, well, let me write this as just F mean field plus delta F and focus on this, on the delta F, okay? Okay, so let's now evaluate this trace. And again, I can use the fact that trace is invariant with respect to the basis change, right? So therefore, to evaluate the trace, I can just diagonalize this matrix, right, which is done by Fourier transform, as we saw, and evaluate the trace in this way, okay, as just sum over different wave vectors. Okay, so then what I get, okay, so I diagonalize the matrix Gij as 1 over n sum over q g of q e to I q dot ri minus rj, right? And now, so delta f is going to be equal to, so 1/2 T, and then trace in this case is just sum over Q, right? Sum over the eigenvalues, log of G inverse of Q. Okay. And so this we have calculated already. So I have 1/2 T sum over Q log of 1 minus 1 over T J of Q, right? Okay, and at this point, let me, so let's actually evaluate the second derivative with respect to temperature, right? So we have all the explicit dependence on T here, and get an expression for the correction to the specific heat right away, okay? Okay, so let's, so I have delta CV, the correction to the specific heat, so that's going to be minus 1 over m t second derivative of the correction to the free energy with respect to temperature, okay? Okay, so let's no, so it's a trace of log, right? So trace was before the log. Okay, so let's do this derivative now. So the first derivative, d delta f dt, so it's going to be 1/2 sum over q log of 1 minus 1 over t j of q, and then the second term is plus 1/2 t sum over q, get 1 over 1 minus j of q divided by t, and then I have to differentiate this minus 1 over t squared, minus 1 over t, so that's going to give me so j of q here, and then 1 over t squared, right? Right? So this is 1/2 sum over q log 1 minus 1 over t j of q, and then plus 1 over 2t sum over q j of q 1 minus j of q divided by t. Okay, that's first derivative. Now let's do the second one. Okay, so d2 delta f dt squared. So this will be so again 1 over 2t squared sum over q j of q 1 minus 1 over t j of q, and then here I have so actually same term but with a minus sign, so that's very nice. 1 over t squared sum over q j of q minus 1 minus 1 over t j of q, and then finally so minus 1 over 2 t cubed sum over q j squared of q, and then 1 minus 1 over t j of q squared, right? So these two terms cancel. And so I just have minus 1 over 2 t sum over q. And so let me write it like this. J of q divided by t 1 minus j of q divided by t and everything squared, right? Okay, so this is the sum that I have to, sum over q that I have to evaluate. Okay, so I get delta CV, right, is equal to now plus 1 over 2n, the t's cancel, sum over q, and then j of q divided by t, 1 minus j of q divided by t squared, okay? Okay, so I need to evaluate the sum over q, and so we do this by, again, by converting the sum to an integral, right, which we've already learned how to do that before, so I have, if you remember, sum over q translates into integral d dq divided by 2 pi to the d and the volume of the system, right? Because this is the, again, this is the volume per one state in the wave vector space. So then, so I have L to the D sum over Q, right? This goes into integral D dQ 2 pi to the D, 2 pi to the D, and so, and then L to the D divided by N is the volume of the unit cell, so A to the D. Right, where A is the lattice constant. So then this integral becomes delta CV is equal to 1/2 A to the D integral D dQ 2 pi to the D this thing J of Q divided by t, 1 minus j of q divided by t squared, okay? Okay, now let me use our small wave vector expansion for j of q to evaluate this integral. So the justification for this is that, as we will see, the problems in evaluating this integral arise from precisely from small q, okay? So to assess whether this integral converges or not, I can use just a small wave vector expansion for J of Q. Okay, it's not obvious now, but it will be obvious in just a few seconds. Okay. So let's erase this. Okay, so let me use my result for small q expansion of J of Q that we've derived before. So this is equal to k capital J minus 1/2 K times Q squared, okay? Okay, so let's just plug this into this integral. So I get delta CV equals 1/2 A to the D integral D DQ 2 pi to the D. And then I have, so J divided by T, so this will be divided by T, right, minus 1 over 2 T times K times Q squared, okay, and then here in the denominator I have 1 minus J divided by T plus 1/2 1 over 2 T K divided by Q squared, okay? And now you see, okay, so now you see where problems may potentially come from, right? So this J is just TC. So when T is equal to TC, this thing here vanishes, right? And therefore the integrand becomes singular at Q equals zero, okay? It just behaves as 1 over Q to the fourth, okay? While, so here, this Q squared is really unnecessary, right? If you are focusing on small Q behavior here, I can just ignore the Q squared. It's not gonna do any harm in the numerator, okay? Okay, so let me rewrite this now in terms of TC. So this is equal to, let me continue here. So delta CV is 1/2 A to the D integral D DQ 2 pi to the D. I have TC divided by T in the numerator, and then 1 minus TC divided by T plus 1 over 2 T Q squared, okay? Now, okay, so let me change integration variables here. It will be convenient. Let me introduce a dimensionless wave vector. I will call it capital Q. And so this is going to be Q times A, okay? It's dimensionless because Q has dimensions of inverse length. So let me rewrite this in terms of this thing. So then this A to the D in front will disappear, and I'll have 1/2 integral D D capital Q 2 pi to the D. Okay. So here I have TC divided by T, and then 1 minus TC divided by T, and then, sorry, I forgot a capital K here. So plus 1 over 2 T K times A squared times capital Q squared, right? Sorry, divided by A squared. squared. And now let me do the following. Let me just pull out this this coefficient of q squared in front. So this is equal to so 1/2 integral dq 2π to the g, right? So I will have so 4t squared, right? A to the fourth divided by k squared, okay? Then I have tc divided by t, okay? And let me actually move this t to the denominator. So I have t minus tc, and then divided by so k so what is the problem here? K times no, so there's no problem. K times and then times 2a squared, right? Right, and then plus q squared, everything squared. And now, so this combination, again, as you should remember, this is just 1 over the correlation length, of the 1 over the mean field correlation length squared, right? So this is equal to, so let me move all of this in front.
Can I try to guess ahead of where you're going here? That ddq term is going to give you like a q to the d minus 1.
Yeah, exactly. So whether this, the point is will be that, you know, whether this integral converges or not is going to depend on dimensionality of space. Yeah.
And it'll converge when like d to the d, say q to the d minus 1 over q to the 4 is
Yeah. So yeah, we will see what's it going to be exactly. Okay. Okay. So let's. Okay. Sorry, I've got a little confused with the. We saw the prefactors here, which are not important actually, but just want to get all of them right. So I have, yeah, yeah.
I'm not sure where the d squared out of the big fraction comes from.
T squared.
But then we are lowering the t inside the numerator of the big fraction.
You are right. Yeah. So this t squared is not. Yeah. Exactly. That's a good point. Okay. Yes. That's why I got confused. Thank you. Okay. So, okay. So I have. It's very good. So I have two. I guess a to the fourth. Right, and then I have 2a to the fourth tc, and actually, let me replace this tc by j again. Okay, so you will see why. J divided by k squared. I mean, the reason I want to do this is because this ratio j divided by k also has a certain physical meaning. Yeah.
So I actually have a question. When you set the 1 over 2 t k q squared to 0, what was our justification for that? I don't
Here.
Yeah.
You mean here? Well, the point is that so here Q is important because if I just ignore it, right, then all I have is this, and this just diverges. This just goes to zero when t equals tc, right? So I have to retain Q squared, while nothing happens with this thing. This just becomes equal to one when t is equal to tc. So I can ignore this Q squared compared to one, right? I mean, the point is that the danger to this integral again comes from small q's. So this integral, if it diverges, is going to diverge at small q. Right. So therefore, what happens in the denominator, the small corrections coming from this term are not important. Yeah. Yeah. Well, we are looking to see whether this integral diverges or not. Okay. So basically, it's not going to be an issue of, small fluctuations versus not small. It's going to be an issue of divergent fluctuations or not. Okay, so it's much worse than just small or not small. Okay, so and then I have integral dq 2 pi to the d, and this is going to be, I guess, 1 over q squared plus a squared divided by correlation length squared and everything squared. Okay. Now let's just see what that ratio, what is the meaning of that, of this ratio here. Okay. Okay. So my j again is sum, or I can write it like this, 1 over m, sum on I and j, capital J I j, while k is 1 over m d, sum on I and j, j I j, and then r I minus rj squared, right? So therefore, I can say that the ratio of k divided by j, right? So it's basically going to be the square of the effective range of the interaction, meaning the square of the distance at which this interaction is non-negligible, right? I mean, you can just see it from dimensional analysis. So this k has dimensions of j times distance squared, right? While this has dimensions of j. So therefore, their ratio will have dimensions of length squared, and that length is clearly something that tells you about the range of the interaction, right? So let me just call this combination d, just to eliminate this 1 over d here. So dk divided by j, I will call this capital R, okay? And this just tells me how long range my interaction between the spins is, okay? So this is effective spin-spin interaction range. Okay, so then I can rewrite this integral in a very nice form. So let me erase this thing. So then I get delta CV is equal to twice A divided by R to the fourth, right? Integral d dq 2 pi to the d, 1 over q squared plus a squared divided by psi squared, everything squared. Okay. Yeah. Sorry? Yeah, so 2d squared. Okay, sorry. So, I mean, all of these prefactors are not really important, but yeah, let's be careful. Thank you. Okay, so now let's finally analyze this. So let's analyze this exactly. Let's analyze how this behaves exactly at the critical point first. Okay, so let's take t equals tc. Well, because so it's this. Sorry again. This is r squared, of course. Yeah, because of this. Okay, so let's take t equals tc. So exactly at t equals tc, this correlation length is infinite, right? So psi goes to infinity, so this term just disappears. So then I get 2d squared a divided by r to the fourth integral d capital Q 2 pi to the d. And then 1 over q to the fourth, right? So since the integrand is spherically symmetric, I can write this ddq as this surface area of unit sphere in d dimensions times q to d minus 1, right? So this ddq, I can just write as s to the d. Q d minus 1 dq, where s to the d, not that it's important, but let's just write it out. So this is equal to 2 pi to d over 2 and gamma function of d over 2. So this is, again, this is surface area of a sphere of unit radius of a unit sphere in d dimensions. Okay, so in three dimensions, this is equal to 4 pi. Okay, but the really important thing is this. Okay, so let's just plug it in here. So I get 2 d squared a divided by r to the fourth s sub d 2 pi to the d, and then the integral. Okay, so one thing I did not mention. So what are the limits of this integral? Okay, so the limits are, as you remember, the wave vector q is restricted to the first Brillouin zone. So the small q goes, the magnitude goes roughly between minus pi, the magnitude of q goes from 0 to roughly pi over a, right? So this dimensionless one goes from 0 to pi, okay? So from 0, again, whether it's pi or some other number doesn't matter. It's just what matters is that this is a finite number, okay? From 0 to pi, d capital Q, and then I have Q, so d minus 1 minus 4, this is d minus 5, right? Okay, and so now it's clear that whether this integral converges or not depends on dimensionality, right? So everything is fine at the upper limit because it's finite, right? But at the lower limit, so we have, so if dimensionality is greater than 4, right? So then this power is always greater than minus 1, right? And then this integral always converges. So the integral converges, right? Which means that we get some correction to delta CV, which is of order 1, okay? So we get a correction to CV from mean field theory, which is of order one of order one, okay? So in this case, we can say that mean field theory is fine, okay? Maybe not quantitatively, but qualitatively is fine. So for example, okay, so the fact that this correction is of order one means that my specific heat critical exponent alpha is still zero, right? Because I still get just a finite jump of the specific heat at the critical temperature. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So alpha, again, so fine means that it doesn't necessarily mean that this correction is much smaller than 3/2, which is the jump of the specific heat at the critical temperature in mean field theory, but it's still a finite jump, okay? And so so this does not change the specific heat critical exponent. And it can be shown that the same is true for all other critical exponents. For all other quantities, if the dimensionality is greater than 4, mean field critical exponents hold, okay? So in this sense, what this means is that if dimensionality of space is greater than 4, mean field theory works fine. So it predicts exactly the values of the critical exponents, okay? So mean field theory predicts correctly the values of all the critical exponents. So, you know, if our space was five dimensional, then we could stop here, right? If all we cared about was five dimensions and above, the theory of critical phenomena would be done at this point, right? We wouldn't have to do anything else. However, if dimensionality is less than 4, and this is what we care about mostly, then this integral actually diverges, okay? And so clearly, in this case, mean field theory fails. Okay, so there is no finite jump of the specific heat. Specific heat actually diverges. And I mentioned to you before that this is, in fact, what's observed. So typically, at continuous transitions, it's actually observed experimentally that the specific heat has a divergence rather than a jump. Okay. And so this means that in less than 4 dimensions we just cannot use mean field theory to predict correctly the values of the critical exponents. So we have to do better than mean field theory. Yeah.
Can we read the values of the critical exponents?
Yeah. So we will do that. Yeah. Although it's still going to be incorrect. So okay. It will be better than just mean field theory, but still wrong, okay? Okay, so this d equals 4 then is called the upper critical dimension and so the physical meaning again is that if dimensionality is greater than the upper critical dimension, mean field theory works, while if dimensionality is less than critical dimension, mean field theory fails, okay? And so, as you will see later, what we'll be able to do is, this renormalization group procedure for calculating critical exponents, which I will introduce later, basically works as an expansion in dimensionality, in the deviation of dimensionality from 4, So what you can do is let the dimensionality be kind of a continuous variable. And then if we deviate slightly from 4, if dimensionality is slightly less than 4, we will be able to set up kind of a perturbation theory in dimensionality and calculate in a controlled way the critical exponents. Okay? No, so in this case, so we will see that in this case, you know, the critical exponents will acquire, well, first of all, a non-trivial dependence on dimensionality, but also dependence on the type of order parameter on the symmetry.
For D equals 4 or for D less?
For D less than 4, yeah. Well, D equals 4 is kind of a special case, right? It's exactly this upper critical dimension. So in this case, there are logarithmic corrections to various quantities. So we won't talk much about that. It's kind of a special case. It's a transition between the two regimes. Okay. Okay. So now let's actually look a little bit more at this correction to CV. And now let's see how it actually diverges at TC, okay? So let's assume now that T is close, but not exactly equal to TC. And let's see what this predicts for how CV actually diverges as T goes to TC, okay? And so from this, we will get our first non-trivial result for a critical exponent, okay? First non-mean field result for this critical exponent alpha. It's still going to be incorrect, but it's going to be better than mean field result. Okay, so let's look at this equation now. And let me plus. So let's do the following. Let me again change the integration variables. So what I want to do now is extract the dependence of delta CV on this correlation length, okay? So to do this, I want to change the integration variables again so that the dependence on psi is outside of the integral, okay? So let me change variables like this. Let me introduce a new integration variable, k, which is also going to be dimensionless. And I'll define this as q times psi divided by a, right? So then I get the following result that delta CV is equal to 2d squared a divided by r to the fourth. So then, so I will have, when I change the my integration variables, I will have a factor of q to the xi to the fourth coming from here, right? And then a factor of xi to minus d coming from the integration measure, right? So I'll get xi over a to the power 4 minus d, right? and then an integral, okay? And let me write it like this. So I will just to point out what the ranges of the integration are. So the range of the integration over Q was from 0 to pi, right? As far as the magnitude is concerned. So the range of this integration is going to be from 0 to pi xi divided by a. So 0 to pi xi divided by a d dk now to pi to the d, right? And the integrand is now just 1 plus k squared squared, okay? Okay, and now I'm going to use the fact that near TC, psi is very large. And therefore, I can just put the upper limit of the integral to infinity. Okay, so this is equal to 2d squared a divided by r to the fourth psi divided by a to 4 minus d. And then integral from 0 to infinity d dk 2 pi to the d 1 divided by 1 plus k squared squared, okay? And this integral is now a simple number, okay? Conveniently, it also converges. But now, so this converges when d is less than 4, okay? So this is just a number, finite number, which I won't even calculate, it doesn't matter. Finite number when d is less than 4, okay? So then what we get is that our correction to CV depends on psi in this way. So it's 2d squared a divided by r to the fourth. And let me just get rid of this 2d squared as well, since I'm writing it as of the order. So of order a divided by r to the fourth, psi divided by a to 4 minus d, okay? And psi, as we know, diverges as 1 over square root of the reduced temperature, 1 over square root of T minus TC divided by TC. And so then we get a result for how delta CV diverges. So I get delta CV going as absolute value. Let me actually retain A over R. So this goes as A divided by R to the fourth, and then T to minus, so 4 minus d over 2, so 2 minus d over 2, right? And so this is now my result for the critical exponent alpha. So we get alpha equals 2 minus d over 2, which is positive when d is less than 4 and goes to 0 as d approaches 4. So as I come to 4 dimensions, the critical exponent becomes the mean field critical exponent, okay? And so here we see for the first time how at least a non-trivial dimension on dimensionality appears in the critical exponents, okay? Now, so the reason I wanted to retain this this prefactor here is the following. So what we can do now is estimate when mean field theory is actually fine in the following sense. That so all these problems with the mean field theory arise when t is very close to tc, right? If we are sufficiently far, mean field theory may be fine, okay? And a quantitative kind of estimate of that would be, again, if this correction is small compared to mean field result of 3/2 for the jump at TC. Okay. So if again delta CV is much less than one, we can still use mean field theory, and mean field theory is useful, right? For example, for predicting what phases may in general occur, right, in a particular situation. It's just not good for looking precisely at the critical phenomena, for figuring out what the properties of the transitions are. Okay. So we don't want to discount mean field theory completely. And so this criterion will tell us, you know, how close can we come to the critical point when mean field theory, you know, is still fine. So if delta CV is much less than one, mean field theory is fine. Okay, and so this tells us that so we have to have T to minus alpha, and then A divided by R to the fourth has to be much less than one, or T to minus alpha has to be much less than R divided by A to the fourth. So this is called Ginzburg criterion. And so what this tells us, and so this is the reason I wanted to introduce this quantity R, the effective range of the interaction. What this tells us is that the longer the range of the interaction between the spins in our microscopic model, the better we can expect the mean field theory to work, right? The closer we can come to the critical temperature where T is zero, without you know, this connection to specific heat being very large. Okay. And so, you know, this is the reason why, as I already mentioned, so there is one particular instance where mean field theory works really well. And so this is the superconductor to normal metal transition in a regular metallic superconductors. And the reason there, again, as I mentioned, is that, you know, so the basically superconductivity again arises due to pairing of electrons, right? And so it's this range of the interaction in that context means the size of the Cooper pairs, okay, the size of the electron pairs. And so in regular metallic superconductors, this size is very large, okay, which means that you have to come really, really close to TC to actually see that mean field theory fails. And that size is that range is typically, you know, well beyond experimental precision. So if you measure specific heat in a regular metallic superconductor, you will actually see a jump. Okay, you would see a divergence, but you'd have to come really close to the critical temperature. Right. Well, it's not correlation. It's the range of this microscopic interaction, JAJ. Right. The correlation, even if the range of the interaction is small, the correlation can still get infinite, right, near the.
So
it's
effectively like the number of spacings in the lattice you can go
before J. Right. Yeah. So we can say that, you know, JAJ, let's say, some J zero times an exponential of Ri minus Rj divided by R. So that would be this R, right? Right. Right. So yeah, it's a good point. So why is it that mean field theory fails in low dimensions? The reason is fluctuations, right? So you see, so the fact that we get these divergent contributions from small q's, So that means small qs mean long wavelength fluctuations of the fields phi in real space. Okay? So it's these long wavelength fluctuations that destroy mean field theory. Okay? Well, you know, so the and right, so the reason okay, so what do we do in mean field theory, right? We have our spins, let's say, on some lattice, and we replace an interaction between a given spin and its neighbors by a mean field that's uniform everywhere, right? That's how mean field theory works, and so you can expect that this should work better and better the more neighbors you have, the more neighbors a given spin has, right? So as if I increase dimensionality of space, the number of nearest neighbors for a spin grows with dimensionality, okay? And so this is why mean field theory works better and better as you increase dimensionality. On the other hand, if you decrease dimensionality, it means that, yeah, fluctuations grow basically, because spin in a given spin interacts only with a few nearest neighbors, and therefore you can expect fluctuations to be stronger and stronger. And in fact, as we'll see later, you know, if we decrease dimensionality further, eventually it may happen that transition just disappears completely, right? So for example, in the case of the Ising model, the transition disappears in one dimension, right? So if you have just a chain of spins, linear chain of spins, it actually does not have a phase transition. It's always in a paramagnetic phase. The average of sigma is always non-zero at any finite temperature. Okay, and the more components the spins have, the more severe this is, right? Because they can fluctuate in more ways, right? So typically this kind of loss of phase transition happens actually in two dimensions. Okay, but so we will talk more about this later. Yeah.
Can you think about this in terms of like if I have, say, with the thing with one dimension, if I have like one spin sitting here and it's got one neighbor that's the opposite spin.
Right.
Then it's only got one neighbor that might be the same spin, which would be incentivized, like it's got a 50-50 incentivization to put.
Yeah. So something like that. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so now the question is, what do we do, right? So what this calculation tells us is that mean field theory is actually wrong completely for dimensionality less than 4. Even this result that we get here, you know, we can't really trust it, because we've obtained this by expanding around mean field solution, assuming that fluctuations are small, right? I expanded S of phi around phi equals phi bar, and I cut off this expansion at second order. So that can only be okay if the fluctuations are actually small, right? But this result tells us that fluctuations are not small. So obviously, mean field theory just does not work, and we have to somehow do better, okay? So this is where we will be soon, after a few more steps, coming to renormalization group. Okay, so let me erase this. Let me write out again my Landau-Ginzburg functional. So we will continue working with that. 1 over 2t, sum on I and j, phi I, j, I, j, inverse, phi j, minus sum over I, log of twice hyperbolic cosine of pi I divided by t, okay? So what this calculation that we have done suggests is that, you know, we actually should focus our attention on kind of long wavelength properties of this functional, right? Since so these bad diverging corrections to mean field theory comes from small wave vectors. So small wave vectors mean long range fluctuations, and you know, so to really to work with this functional, we really want to simplify it, right? Because it looks really ugly and complicated. Unfortunately, you know, this desire to simplify it is not in disagreement with what we actually have to do, meaning focus on long wavelength properties of this thing. Okay, so we want to focus on long wavelength, well, sort of large distance properties of S of phi. Okay. Basically, what we need to the information that's of interest to us is the information of, you know, are the properties of this functional on the scale of the correlation length, right? Whereas this thing actually contains information of what happens on the scale of the lattice spacing, right? So this contains the actual microscopic interaction between the spins. And so this kind of information is unnecessary for us. We don't need it. So what I want to do now is simplify this and derive this form of this functional that will be valid at long wavelength. And as we will see, the form of this functional at long wavelength is going to be much simpler and universal, in the sense that it will depend only on kind of symmetry properties of phi and symmetry properties of space, like inversion symmetry. Okay. And so this is already kind of the first step of renormalization. Okay. So it's you know, this idea is important not just in statistical mechanics, not just in the theory of critical phenomena, but in condensed matter and physics in general. So this is how we model solids, right? So in principle, we know the microscopic theory of solids very well, right? We just take the Hamiltonian of all the atoms, all the electrons in there, just write it down. But the problem is that this Hamiltonian is extremely complicated. We can't really do anything with that. Even though we know the Hamiltonian exactly, we can't actually solve this quantum mechanical problem of, you know, many electrons and many atoms in the crystal lattice of a solid. So this theory is kind of an analog of that. So we have a microscopic theory of our Ising model, but it's complicated. Okay? We can't really solve it exactly. Okay? But then the way we actually model solids is write down an effective Hamiltonian that depends maybe on a couple of parameters that's supposed to capture the physics that we are actually interested in, which typically happens on, again, on long length scales and low energies. Low energies meaning energies which are small compared to the atomic energies. Right? Let's say like the binding energy of the hydrogen atom, which would be 13 electron volts. So typical energies we are interested in solids are less than one electron volt, so much smaller than that. And so it's kind of the same idea here. So we are starting from a microscopic theory and then want to want to go to an effective theory, which is simpler than this, and which works on long length scales, okay? So for this, for the Ising model, we can actually go through all the steps of this transformation exactly. For you know, for a typical phenomena in solids, we can't actually do this. And so writing down this low energy, long wavelength effective Hamiltonian is done by sort of physical insight, right? You can't actually derive it in most cases. But here, you know, the conceptual importance of what we are doing is not just you know, for the theory of critical phenomena, but this is really how we should think about going from microscopic description, which is too complicated, to an effective long wavelength, low energy description. Okay. No, this is exact, right? This just comes from the Hubbard-Sertonovich transformation, so this is exactly equivalent to the original Ising model. Okay, so the first thing I want to do is I want to get rid of this Jij inverse, okay? And so this I will do by using our result for the Fourier transform of J. Which is valid at small q, and that's precisely what we want. Small q means long distances in real space. So J of q is approximately equal to J minus 1/2 k q squared. So let's first just focus on this term here, and let's see how this approximation simplifies it. Okay. So let me call this. Let me call this S0, this quadratic part of the Landau-Ginzburg functional. Let me call this S0 phi. So this is equal to 1/2 sum on I and j, phi I, j I j inverse phi j, okay? So let's transform this into Fourier space, okay? So I'll say phi is equal to 1 over n. So just make one small correction to the previous lecture. I've defined before the Fourier transform of phi with 1 over square root of n. It's actually more convenient to define it with 1 over n. Okay. It doesn't really change anything. Just replace 1 over root n by 1 over n in the previous lecture. Okay, so I have 1 over n sum over q phi q e to I q dot r I. I mean, the only thing this changes is that now phi q is going to be just sum over I without 1 over root n or without 1 over n, right? Okay, so let's just take this and plug this in here. And I guess then I'll finish. So I have S0 of phi is equal to 1 over 2t. So I want to Fourier transform everything in here. So I'll have three factors of 1 over n, right, from each phi and from Gij inverse. So I get 1 over n cubed sum on I and j, and then sum over, let's say, q1, q2, and q3, phi q1 j inverse of q2 phi q3 let me actually write this as phi of q1, so that's the same as phi sub q1, j inverse of q2 phi of q3. And then I have E to I Q1 dot Ri, right? E to I Q2 dot Ri minus Rj, and then E to I Q3 dot Rj, right? And so here we want to use, again, this main identity of Fourier transforms, as I called it, that 1 over m sum over I of E to either plus or minus, let me use plus, Q1 minus Q2 dot Ri, this is equal to Kronecker delta of Q1 and Q2, right? So here we will have two Kronecker deltas, right? So from summing over I will get Kronecker delta of Q1 and minus Q2, right? And then from summing over J, I will get Kronecker delta of Q2 and Q3. So the whole thing is then equal to 1 over 2T, there is 1 power of n that's left, sum over just a single Q, right? I had 3 Q before, but there are 2 constraints now, so just 1 Q is left. I get phi of minus Q, right? J inverse of Q and phi of Q. Okay, and so let's stop at this point and we will continue on Tuesday, because Monday is a holiday. Okay?